Welcome to the last post radio show podcast series, a series you can download at any time and listen to anywhere. We've been having some interesting guests on the last post radio show podcast series, none more so than Ben Wadham, professor of sociology, defense and veteran studies, and criminological research on the ADF and DVA. And Ben, of course, is director of Open Door, designed to improving the well-being of veterans, and we'll be giving out the Open Door number at the end of this chat with Ben for those that may need it. We're here primarily to talk about Ben's new book with James Connor, Warrior Soldier Brigand, about institutional abuse within the Australian Defence Force. Ben, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me today.
No, it's an utmost pleasure and of utmost importance too, I imagine, too, for the majority of those serving and the general community. We do give thanks to serving and former ADF members for their sacrifice and contributions. And Ben, this is an insightful, it's been called insightful, significant examination of the problems that have existed in our ADF for decades. Do you agree with that comment?
I do think it's an important book, piece of work. I guess I partly say that because really there's no one else in Australia that is researching institutional abuse in the Australian Defence Force. Mm-hmm. It has been a enduring and persistent issue for as long as the Australian Defence Force or the Australian Armed Forces have existed. But it's a sort of an issue which gets discovered, usually through a scandal. Then it hits the media and it turns into an inquiry, then an inquiry turns into recommendations, and then it disappears, and we wait for the next scandal to rediscover it. So this book is about creating a historical record, and they're very kind words from the lead commissioner for the Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide, Nick Cowdes.
Yes, Nick did a marvellous job. We'll talk about that a bit more later on. It's an honest book, inspiring in itself and its honesty, but I guess it could be no other way.
No, it's a very difficult subject area to broach, and you know the book tries to put it into a historical and institutional and cultural context. So we're trying to move beyond seeing, you know, the physical assault, the sexual assault, the institutional abuses, an interpersonal thing. We're arguing that it is endemic to the institution, and really there's no other way to talk about some of those the cases that we've written about. So 60 about 65 interviews that made up this book. And then the material was also drawn upon for the report for the Royal Commission called Mapping Service and Transition to Self-Harm and Suicidality. The Royal Commission came in, you know, it began on the terms of understanding deployment trauma and the mental health of veteran individuals. We gave expert testimony on day one in Brisbane, and the Royal Commission explained to us very generously that we'd opened up a new line of inquiry for them, culture and systems. At the end of the Royal Commission, on its conclusion, the finding was that more veterans suffered from self-harm and suicidality for those that hadn't been deployed than those that had.
Yeah. Look, I guess Ben, the take from the book, obviously, and if the ADF has fostered forms of violence and violation, how have they been able to get away with that?
Yeah, well, I guess that's why we look at the culture and the systems element. You know, we live in a society where we have state relationships between the state, the military, and civil society, and it's a good reason for that. It's a kind of a form of separation of powers, you know, so that we don't end up politicizing the military, and the military
essential
end up dominating politics. So the downside of that is that the military, the Australian Defence Force, is quite sort of isolated as an institution, and it sees itself as quite separate. A separate society, I suppose, and exceptional. It sees itself as you know, it has a very unique job, and sees itself as, unfortunately, it can translate into sort of a sense of superiority, I guess. I served. It is a difficult job. There are unique elements to it. We do things which other people don't do. But every soldier's career ends, and they end up back in Civvy Street. So the point is that structurally, defence is an isolated institution, and it has a rank structure. It's hierarchical. It's regimental. It's command and control. You've got the officer class, and you have your NCOs and other ranks, and it's quite insular. So the institution is a total institution. That means that when you go into it in there, you're there for 24/7 for however long you serve. Your healthcare is looked after. Your postings, your housing, all that sort of stuff. But the key thing is that military justice is total. And that gives complete authority to a commander to use discretion to discipline subordinates. And so what we saw through our research is that that enables a sort of a an officer cabal, if you like, where officers look after each other and generally try to close down reporting and look after each other's careers. That is one of the ways in which reporting is reduced or diminished.
Yes.
When people do report, we found that commanders could apply what we call administrative violence. That's where the commander shoots the messenger, if you like. So the way that they can do that is by losing leave paperwork or postings, creating challenging postings, reducing courses, deployments, just making life hard for the service member. So it's able to perpetuate this and not look at this adequately by the structure of the institution and the culture of command.
Was the recent inquiry into war crimes in Afghanistan an example of that?
Yeah, I think it's a very good example of that. Brereton, who did the inquiry, talks about a violent elitism, and that's not too far away from a violent exceptionalism. This idea that we have a hard job to do, and we'll do whatever we can to get it done. And of course, this flies in the face of any attempts to uphold the rules of war. I think the fun, obviously this is contested. But for me, I joined the military to uphold liberal democratic values. And what we see when soldiers go rogue, command goes rogue, is that it becomes authoritarian and serving its own interests above the interests of the Australian people.
I think the upholding of liberal democratic values is essential in belief and in acting too, I guess, as we experience real or imagined threats from various countries and the potential for a challenge to democracy in some of our allies, that belief is essential. And I can understand you saying that. How do we move on from, predominantly male-based institution, but obviously more inclusive and open now, but have we successfully moved on from that image or that belief that it's predominantly male-dominated?
I guess one thing to note is that, the ADF isn't Robinson Crusoe with this issue. Police institutions and other paramilitary institutions clearly have these sort of issues as well. And, even universities have issues of sexual impropriety as well. The ADF is still 80% male. It's increased its participation of women predominantly in the Navy and the Air Force. That they have higher rates of women there. The army's still low. I might be wrong here, but I think it's about 12 to 15%. It historically is an almost exclusively male institution. And the work of war is, almost historically almost exclusively male too. So the culture is, if you're in an infantry battalion, for example, you live 24/7 on that base, at least in the beginning, with other men. You work hard and you play hard, and unless you have some sort of cultural protocol or good leadership, then boys will be boys, unfortunately. And That includes, you know, racism and misogyny and heavy drinking and, you know, other sorts of things as well. So still very male dominated, but it's not just the numbers, it's the fact that the whole culture actually still centers around men and men's ways of being. We've done research with women, we've talked to female service members, and that is the overarching, the overall experience that they have, is that they come into the services and they have to meet, they have to bend to meet the demands of men's culture.
Mm-hmm. Is there hope for change?
Oh yeah, I think so. I mean, it's not all bad. I mean, we need that. We do need that sort of masculinity, or at least that disposition in war. I mean, it's a tough environment, and you're not going to win it by trying to break that down completely. So we've seen an increase of women since 1985. It was very difficult for women in the first 10 years or so. Women still experience challenges, but we now have women in very high ranking positions, such as 3 stars, more women as senior NCOs, and at least some kind of lip service, if not some attempts to improve equality and the inclusion of women and others in the military, in the Australian Defence Force. And, you know, the really poignant piece here is that the Australian Defence Force is below its staffing requirements. It's having real retention issues, and its recruitment is struggling as well. So you have to be able to appeal to a larger talent pool, and that includes women and people of diversity.
Yes, in true, more of an accurate reflection of the society that is being defended. You're with Greg T. Ross and Professor Ben Wadham on the Last Post radio show, and we'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Greg T. Ross and the Last Post radio show.
Welcome back to the Last Post radio show. You're with Greg T. Ross and Professor Ben Wadham. We're here talking about Ben's book with James Connor, Warrior Soldier Brigand, Institutional Abuse Within the Australian Defence Force. Ben, the culture of bulletproof, I suppose we touched on this a bit before, but the attitude, working and playing hard, is that largely responsible for a lot of this belief in being above the law?
Yeah, look, I describe it as a sense of license. You know, we'll go back to A Few Good Men and Colonel Jessup, if you remember the movie, and he talks about the code red, and that's where the bullying and harassment ended up in the death of one of the soldiers. And he expected to get away with it, if you remember, in that movie. And then in the final scenes, he talks about walking those walls that to keep them so the rest of us can sleep soundly at night. It's that belief, right? It's that exceptionalism that you are doing a job that no one else can do, and therefore you throw the rules out and you can do whatever you want to get the job done, that creates this kind of environment. So that manifests in a sense of license among commanders and young men in battalions, and it results in both commanders and the service members engaging in this kind of behaviour, which is, you know, physical assault, sexual assault. We also found, you know, really strong evidence of reputational damage and sabotage, and as I mentioned before, the administrative violence as well. So this is the basis of poor human resource behaviour, but also criminality. You know, sexual assault, physical assault is criminal. So yeah, it's that belief that we're different from the rest of Australia and a little bit better than them, and that somehow we think that justifies for some veterans, for some members of the Defence Force, that sort of behaviour.
It's an interesting call, Ben, and one that again I guess is a reflection of some parts of society too, unfortunately. But the recent Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide, Ben, how has that shone a light on the cultural and systematic issues that confront the ADF and DVO?
Yeah. As I mentioned, it wasn't maybe an area that they were looking at too closely to begin with. But as the commission rolled on and as I mentioned, our research was included. They ended up with the finding that actually this is the key source of veteran suicidality. So, what, 11 volumes? No, 7 volumes. And 122 recommendations. One of those recommendations is around a big piece of research on military sexual assault. And then there's the independent body to oversee Defence's management of the recommendations, but also some would like to see it go into managing redress of grievances as well outside of the chain of command. So the Royal Commission has identified this. It's backed it up with really strong research, and it's made recommendations to address these cultural and system issues.
Mm-hmm. Warrior Soldier Brigand, how is the title of this book significant, Ben?
Well, to me, there's a level of idealism. I admit that. But if we don't try and aspire to be the best military personnel that we can, if we don't aspire to uphold those values of our broader society, then we're not being the best soldiers that we can. So the best soldier, and what I'm arguing is the warrior. And that's not the the kind of, there's a few definitions of warrior that float around the military space. One of them's the more of the hyper masculinity, which the Brereton report identified. I'm really pointing to an ideal version of the warrior, and probably based largely on Eastern sort of ideas of mercy, the judicious use of violence as a last resort, compassion, using violence really only to serve a higher purpose. The soldier, so that's the warrior. The soldier is most of us. We join as young people, and then we're indoctrinated into the military way, and we get up and we do our job and serve the system. So that's the soldier. But when we have the violent extremism that we've seen in Afghan, or a commander that stalks or rapes his subordinate, or a group of men using physical violence to exclude others, then that's rogue. And that's the brigand, the robber, the mercenary. And
the bandit.
So yeah, that's it. So that's the idea of the title, is to appeal to a higher form of soldiering.
No, a brilliant title. Brilliant title. It's grabbing. Look, there's lots of types of abuse. I suppose you mentioned in the book the different patterns of abuse and how they're different across the services. Can you just give us a brief rundown of what you mean by that?
Yeah, we identify three pillars, I suppose. Maybe you can think of them as dials. The three pillars are the martial element, the fraternal element, so fraternity, and the exceptionalism that I've talked about. And so the martial element is the masculine element. And of course, that's strongest in your arms corps. And so obviously the army is probably the most martial of the services, and particularly when you're in an infantry battalion or an artillery or armoured, but you also find it in Navy clearance divers, SAS, like I mentioned, and say air defence, for example, in the Air Force. They're jobs that are usually dominated by men. They're, as I said before, they're very masculinised cultures. So the martial element is really important, obviously, for defence, because that's what we're there for, to seek out, close in, and kill the enemy. But all of these things can be, those, as I said, the dials, they can all be turned up too high. And the Australian Defence Force recognises this. In 2012, they produced a report on a new professional ethos, and they argued that the Australian Defence Force needs to be less exceptionalist, and that its fraternity, which can create unit cohesion or camaraderie or esprit de corps, as positive terms, if it's dialed too high, it'll create tribalism. And tribalism is prejudicial, discriminatory, and exclusive, and ultimately violent. So stronger in parts of some services than others, makes sense that it's stronger in those martial parts of the Defence Force, as opposed to more service-based elements.
Well described. Finally, I guess we look in positive ways to the future. Otherwise, we wouldn't go on, I guess. But how much of a challenge is it in a real challenge, real reform? How much of a challenge, Ben?
I think it's a massive challenge. You know, we're all very we had to fight for the Royal Commission. When we got it, people were happy, but also, I guess, just wondering whether it would achieve anything useful. I think we've seen the Royal Commission do a great job. It's produced a lot of material that might be a bit of a get out of jail card for government and defence. You know, because there's so much that they've listed. But defence, in order to progress, you know, there's been 57 inquiries over the last four decades, 750 recommendations, and not much has changed. So this, as I mentioned before, recruitment, retention, changing nature of the global geopolitical security environment, defence has to change in order to defend Australia effectively. Mm. It can't do it as a brigand institution, you know. So I think as a rule, you know, we're all, those inquiries I talked about argued that defence in the past, that defence is incapable of managing its own cultural reform. I think, you know, because of those three pillars I talked about, it doesn't have the reflexivity or the ability or the expertise in cultural and human relations to affect it.
Mm.
It's driven by what's called the functional imperative, that is to be tactically dominant, and it marginalizes the societal imperatives. That's the things about equality and respect and opportunity. It's structurally has a disposition to diminish change rather than affect it. So that's a long way of saying that, I hope that defence gets its act together and becomes a different institution and you know, leads by example. But historically, it's not encouraging.
Yeah, well, you know, it's input from both you and, of course, James Connor, that will continue to shine a light on this very important subject. And while there's discussion, there's hope. Professor Ben Wadham, thank you so much for being a part of the Last Post Radio Show podcast series. It's been, as always, an utmost pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Greg. Anytime, I look forward to seeing you in the new year, and I hope you have a good break.